moment is Faiz Mohammed versus Ashcroft, Ms. Coppernoli.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Susan Coppernoli for the petitioner, Khalid Faiz Mohammed. Mr. Faiz Mohammed is asking this court to find that the Department of Homeland Security, formerly the INS, acted illegally when it reinstated an old exclusion order and removed him from the United States without giving him the opportunity to pursue his application for adjustment of status in front of an immigration judge.
The problem I have with your argument is I just don't see how he could have a prayer of relief given his history.
Judge Posner, that actually I'd like to address that. That's just incorrect. An immigration judge hearing is a substantially different creature from an administrative determination. A case looks substantially different when it's presented to an immigration judge. First of all, the immigration judge, there's a statutory right to counsel. An immigration judge hears in-person testimony. It is not at all unusual for an immigration judge to grant adjustment of status to an individual who, like Mr. Faiz Mohammed, needs a fraud waiver, who entered the United States using someone else's documents. In fact, this is what immigration judges do. They hear testimony on difficult adjustment status cases. They allow between...
It doesn't seem like a difficult case because there's such a history of fraud.
There are two instances where he used fraud, and it is not a routine case, but I would say it is far from a case that would be an open and shut losing case in front of an immigration judge. There are two instances of fraud which the immigration judge would balance against the positive factors in his case, which would be the fact there are no criminal convictions, the fact that he otherwise has a good record in the United States, the fact that he has extensive family in the United States. The immigration judge would set aside a block of anywhere between 1 and 4 hours to let Mr. Faiz Mohammed present all of the equities in favor of his being allowed to become a permanent resident and stay in the United States. He would testify. He would be given a chance to rebut the unfavorable factors that the government mentioned in its decision. He would be able to explain how those different dates of birth got on his applications. He would explain the circumstances surrounding his entry to the United States. His wife would testify. She would explain why she feels she would suffer extreme hardship if her husband were not granted an immigrant visa. All of the witnesses would be subject to cross-examination. There would be a full record would be established, and he would have, in my experience in immigration court, he would have a fair shot at getting adjustment of status in front of an immigration judge. Immigration judges, as I said, routinely hear adjustment of status cases that involve substantial fraud and that is a substantial criminal conduct, and in many, many cases, the applicants for relief are successful. In any event, as the Supreme Court pointed out in INS versus St. Cyr, it's not that he has to show an absolute right to be given the relief, but the opportunity to apply for discretionary relief is itself a substantive right. And while the Department of Homeland Security took away that right, it substantially impaired rights he possessed when he acted. When he re-entered the United States, when he married, when his wife naturalized, when he applied for adjustment of status, the old reinstatement of deportation provision was in effect, which could not have been applied to him. That old provision only applies to individuals who are deported on certain grounds, did not apply to individuals in exclusion proceedings, and in any event allowed someone one last chance to apply for discretionary relief in front of an immigration judge before being deported. And indeed, every court of appeals that has looked at this issue and has applied the second step of the Landgraf analysis has found that an individual in Mr. Fayyaz Mohammed's shoes was substantially impaired when reinstatement of removal was applied against him. Even in the two cases in which relief was not granted, I believe it's the third and the fifth circuits, both of those circuits nonetheless acknowledged that the individuals there had not applied for adjustment of status before the law changed. And I think that's a real indication that their decisions might have come out the other way if, in fact, the individual had applied for adjustment of status earlier.
Now, did any of those cases have to deal with the issue we have, though, of whether or not you have to obtain a waiver of inadmissibility antecedent to applying for adjustment of status?
Yes.
Did any of those cases deal with
yes, that? Yes, they did. In fact, I believe it's the Fifth Circuit case that addressed specifically the issue of an individual who entered using someone else's documents and who would need a fraud waiver, and the Eighth Circuit said, well, perhaps this person won't get the waiver, perhaps this person won't get adjustment, but cutting off the right to apply is itself curtailing a substantive right. You know, by definition, all of the people to whom against reinstatement will be applied have done something wrong. They bring it to the United States after being deported or excluded. Some of them are crossing the border, others by using someone else's documents. And in our case, has not been dispositive against the petitioner. And I'm sorry, it's the First Circuit case, Revelo versus Ashcroft, where the petitioner, a woman from Guatemala, re-entered the United States using someone else's documents. And the First Circuit found that that was really irrelevant in its calculation of whether or not she would suffer. She had her substantive rights curtailed when she was reinstated and summarily removed from the United States.
I have some trouble seeing how a substantive right is involved as opposed to simply a procedural right.
Well, it's a substantive right because an immigration judge hearing really, really differs substantially from an administrative adjudication. It is really and truly the individual's day in court and is markedly different from...
Is that a legal distinction or just a practical one?
I think it's a legal distinction, and I think the circuits that have looked at this have agreed that cutting off... The Eighth Circuit actually went so far as to say that cutting off the opportunity to apply for discretionary relief from deportation is cutting off a substantive right. And the Eighth Circuit would allow any pre-IRA entrant who has any relief from deportation to apply for relief from deportation regardless of when they filed the application. The Eighth Circuit case doesn't turn on when the individual filed the application. And yes, you can think of it as another shot at the apple, but it's really much, much more than another shot at the apple. It is a substantively different form. Presenting in-person testimony is substantively different from presenting a 1- or 2-page affidavit. Listening to a wife explain what deportation would do to her or her husband is substantively different from writing it out on paper.
Well, I think Judge Ripple's question is, are there different criteria?
It's a different form.
The immigration judge be using a different legal standard?
The immigration judge would use the same legal standard. The difference is that where there are issues of statutory interpretation that properly are before the immigration judge or the board, the immigration judge would decide those. And there is such an issue in this case, whether or not he needs a waiver for the reentry itself, because he did stay out of the United States for 1 year. That is an issue that really properly belongs in the body of case law developed by the immigration judges and the Board of Immigration Appeals.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Compernell. Mr. Sandu?
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Happy Sandu from the Justice Department on behalf of the respondent in this case. Your Honors, we would ask this Court to affirm the service's reinstatement order. The petitioner is an alien who was excluded he doesn't claim lawfully excluded in 1988. He decided to re-enter the country in 1989 and did so through fraud, illegally. And ever since 1989, he has been in the country illegally, and that effect, that illegal act, has continued until the present time. He has been in the country illegally, hoping to obtain a benefit. And what Congress has done with the reinstatement statute is to thwart that effort and to thwart that hope of obtaining a benefit by remaining in the country illegally. That's simply what this case is about. There is no impermissibly retroactive effect here. The first problem with the argument is that, as the court has pointed out, that even apart from the reinstatement statute, there is a problem with eligibility for adjustment of status because of the fraud. Now, the petitioner points to the Arevalo case. That case involved an acknowledgement by the petitioner that he had committed fraud on his adjustment application, but there had been no finding by the service of fraud. Here there's been a finding he was actually excluded in 1988 for committing fraud. There's an order, you know, that says that he attempted to commit fraud. Now that's clear in the record, and so that's got to be overcome. And in fact, he has to apply for a discretionary hardship waiver and to obtain that. So that's the first barrier. There's another barrier in terms of the I-212 waiver that we've discussed in our briefs as well. So that argument by itself would be a first hurdle for the petitioner to claim an impermissibly retroactive result. But I would argue in the alternative as well that under the Supreme Court's decision in Landgraf and subsequent case law, that this simply is not a retroactive application, what's happening here, in that the denial of adjustment of status, the reinstatement statute, precludes any relief. The petitioner never had a right to adjustment of status, even when he reentered the country, because he wasn't married at that time. He married in 1990, a year after he reentered, and at that point, his wife wasn't even a United States citizen. That's why he never applied for adjustment of status for several years, until after IRERA passed. So at the point when he finally applied and filed an application for adjustment of status, he was on notice by the statute that served as notice to the world that he would be ineligible for adjustment of status, because he filed the adjustment of status application on February 25th, I believe, 1997, and IRERA, which enacted the reinstatement statute, was passed in September of 1996. So several months before. So that's another barrier there. If you're looking at when the application was filed, when the individual was on notice, and of course the Supreme Court talks about notice, and that enters into the retroactivity analysis. But there's nothing here, there's certainly no type of reliance interest that the Supreme Court discussed in St. Cyr that's involved here, and the other side does not argue.
When you first filed for adjustment of status, the new statute was in effect?
No, I should be clear on that. The new statute had been enacted. The statute was enacted in September of 1996. The adjustment of status application was filed in February of 1997. Then the statute, including the reinstatement provision, took effect on April 1, 1997.
So it was not yet in effect.
It was not yet in effect. That's correct.
Terminology is an important thing. I must say I found your brief extremely difficult to read. All of these statutes, you know, have three different citations that you can use of them. And why the IA, why the service has to successively use or mix all three, I really don't know.
I apologize, Your Honor.
Extremely difficult brief to have read. Terminology is important, you're right.
I'll remember that next time. Your Honor, we would argue then that because the application, for another reason, because the application was filed after the enactment of the statute, that there's clearly no retroactive effect. And then finally, even if the application had been filed before the enactment of the statute, as I believe in the Eighth Circuit has held in that case, the Eighth Circuit did find that there was a retroactive effect, we would argue that's simply incorrect under, again, the
retroactive effect? You're saying, I thought, because it's procedural, then, you know, procedural rules are effective from when they're enacted, even though they'll have consequences for people who did something before the law was passed.
That's true. That's part of our argument. And that's exactly what the Fifth Circuit held in the reinstatement case that's cited in our brief. In that case, they found that because the individual was entitled to a hearing before, perhaps, but now was entitled to a determination for an INS officer, because that was a procedural change, that did not implicate retroactivity concerns. But, I mean, we can go down the line in terms of the criteria that the Supreme Court has pointed out in terms of impairing rights the party possessed when he acted, increasing liability. The petitioner in this case is not being made removable based on the reinstatement statute. He's always removable. I mean, there's no issue here that he illegally reentered the country and is removable.
Maybe you could help me with something. A waiver of inadmissibility, generally there's no judicial review. Am I correct?
That's right, Your Honor. If it's in the discretion, which it was in this case, you're talking about the I-212 waiver, the waiver of inadmissibility that was filed because he needed to file that in order to cure that ground of inadmissibility. Mm-hmm. Because that was decided as a matter of discretion by the service because of his prior fraud and other mm-hmm. other conduct, that would be unreviewable under 8 U.S.C. Section 1252. That would be unreviewable.
Is that ever subject to review by an IJ? Under what circumstances would that issue get before an IJ?
The I-212 waiver, I don't believe is within the jurisdiction of the IJ. The IJ would have jurisdiction to review an adjustment application.
And in reviewing the adjustment application, could he, in effect, nullify the service's decision with respect to the waiver of inadmissibility?
By granting
the adjustment of status?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I'm not entirely sure about that. I don't believe that the immigration judge has jurisdiction over to review an I-212 waiver. But in any event, that's all sort of beside the point, because the individual here and the class of individuals who have illegally reentered are clearly ineligible for adjustment of status under the reinstatement statute. And as we've argued in our brief, there's no retroactive effect that can be found here that would counsel otherwise. I mean, the only argument for the court here is saying that the statute shouldn't be read to bar relief because it's an impermissibly retroactive result. And so if it's found that it's not, then we apply the statute and they're not eligible for adjustment of status.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Sanders.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Comprenol, how much time does she have? 1 minute?
I'm afraid I'm going to take a little bit of that minute, if I may, counsel.
Certainly.
This is my biggest stumbling point with your case. He's got this problem with the waiver of inadmissibility. That's normally, as I understand it, not subject to any sort of judicial review. Until he takes care of that, what harm has he really suffered by not getting to talk to an IJ about his waiver of about his adjustment of status? It seems to me he's got this antecedent problem for which there simply is no judicial review. Until he takes care of that, he's got a problem. He just can't get any further.
Judge Ripple, there is immigration judge review of the waiver denial. That is clear in the regulations. It's clear in the case law. 8 CFR 245.1F says that the immigration judge may decide applications for adjustment of status concurrently with any application for waiver of inadmissibility.
Suppose it's already been decided.
He may review it. He may decide it in the first. He or she may decide it in the first instance.
Is there case law that says that?
There's plenty of case law. It's cited on page 8 and 9 of our reply brief. In fact, there is a kind of trial board decision, matter of Cervantes Gonzalez, which arose from the immigration court context and sets out the actual standards for immigration judges to use when deciding a waiver for someone who's committed fraud in the United States. And the fact that the board would issue a precedent decision on something like a fraud waiver shows that it comes in front of immigration judges and comes in front of the board all the time. And you can see from the cases I've cited, too, that there's a long line of jurisprudence on immigration judges deciding not just one narrative of inadmissibility, but several in conjunction with an application for adjustment of status, including waivers for voluntary refugee deportation, waivers for fraud, waivers for criminal grounds, waivers for travel. You know, once again, this is what immigration judges do. They decide the not run-of-the-mill adjustment cases, which almost by definition involve applications for waivers of inadmissibility.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Counsel, the court will be in recess until 9:30 tomorrow morning.